The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Welcome back, folks. We are very pleased today to have one of my favorite guests. He's a great, great person, actually. Is Chief Market Strategist, Senior Managing Director, First Allied Asset Management, Mr. Craig Columbus. Craig is, you see him a lot on Wall Street. He was one of Larry Kudlow's favorites in Kudlow & Company. Of course, Larry's retired now. But you see him on Power Lunch a lot. He was previously the Chief Market Strategist for Thomson Financial. But, you know, Wall Street doesn't have many nice, honest people to it. Particularly the word honest is not one you see a lot on Wall Street. This is a really nice, honest, straightforward person, and that's why I'm pleased to have him on with us today. Good morning, Craig.
Well, that's the most kind introduction. Good morning.
Really? No, you really are. You're the most, you're truly the most honest guy I know. Now, you know, I interview a lot of people, and I'm sure a lot of them are. But I know you a little bit better because of the relationship with First Allied, and you truly are one of the most honest people. And you wrote that great book, God and Man on Wall Street, The Conscience of Capitalism, which I thought was really a wonderful book. So I really just have a lot of personal respect for you. And thank you for being on with us today. What I'd like to ask you this question, just kind of start out. I was talking just before the break about how margin debt is being paid down. And there's all these guys now throwing statistics out there that when it's paid down at this rate, this is what happened to the S&P, all the useless drivel that comes out of the talking heads. But I remember that several weeks ago, one of the concerns that people were expressing about the market, looking for reasons why it might crack and sell off, was the rising margin debt. Now, for the last couple of weeks, apparently it's being paid down. Is there anything we need to draw from that?
I'm not a big fan of those kind of big contrarian indicators, advisory sentiment. And I mean, look, when markets get to extremes in any direction, you tend to markets tend to surprise you the other way. But look, we made another series of new highs, but on very light volume, the holiday volume. And last week, you really just had two catalysts. You had better housing data, and in fairness, the housing data has been really the weak spot. And we've had a whole slew of sort of post-winter weather weak spot, and housing has been, I think, the heart of that darkness of the bleakest pieces of data we've gotten. But we got some better data last week, both on new home sales and on existing home sales. That was part of what the bulls needed. And then we got the Fed minutes, the April Fed minutes, and the Fed basically said, look, we're in no hurry to raise rates. They talked through the process of how they would actually potentially do it. And that was the first time that the Fed has really said in great detail, well, how would we actually try to exit some of our existing positions and what would it look like if we raised rates? But the bulls read into that, look, the Fed is in no hurry. So you got better housing data. Fed said, hey, I'm in no hurry to raise rates, likely not out until 2015. Light volume, here you go, make another new high.
All right. Well, okay. So we have new high on light volume, which is never really good because you that doesn't really show a lot of support. Are you expecting the market to kind of just trend sideways here? It looks like lately it's kind of going nowhere. I mean, we've had a lot of activity this year, but an article I saw just this morning said that the S&P for the year was up like 0.2%. And they're saying really the market has no direction. That there's some concerns out there about when interest rates are going to go up, but as you said, the Fed has frequently confirmed that, hey, we're not in a hurry to raise rates. We seem to have adjusted to the reduction of the quantitative easing, largely because a lot of people said that it wasn't having any impact anyway. Are we in for a sideways market now for the remainder of the year?
Okay, so great point. Come into summer doldrums, which tends to be a period where you're going to chop around. This has been a year that has been somewhat directionless, some would say, because winter weather put the brakes on what was looking like a pretty decent second half recovery. Q3, Q4 of last year, economy starting to show some signs of life, particularly in the third quarter. Winter weather comes, slams the brake. But here's a really interesting thing of what you said about breadth. So yes, we've been making a series of new highs. When you tend to make a new high, you tend to run the table and make a series of them. Some of it's psychological because you have very few fewer people say, I have to get back even before I can sell. That's just psychological literature. And some of it is just pure, when you break out of ties, it's like in NASCAR. You're in clean air, and you tend to go further. But here's the interesting thing. The breadth or the number of individual stocks inside the S&P 500 making their own new highs has been declining. So while the broader averages is going up, making new highs, the number of individual stocks making their own new highs has actually been going down. And that's an indicator that I do like. So breadth has not been there. Light volume and fewer individual stocks making new highs, that usually is not the best backdrop. When you want a recovery or you want a rally, you want it to be wide. The most powerful rallies are wide. Breadth is powerful. We don't have that right now. But look, we're in such very uncharted waters because of the Fed, so the bulls very much still in charge.
Do you have and I realize it's just a guess, because, I mean, I've literally asked everybody, including Dr. Michael Cox, the former chief economist for the Fed, how they're actually going to extricate themselves from this. They've got all that money. I understand it's about $3.5 trillion or something like that sitting at the banks. The current concern out there is, how are we going to really unwind this? I mean, the stopping of quantitative easing is only one part of it. There's still we've created quite a financial machine. Do you have an estimate or a guess of how we're going to unwind all this and the impact it will have?
Such uncharted waters, because the Fed has never had a $4 trillion balance sheet. So how it unwinds it is pure engineering. It's speculation, even on their own part, right? So in the minutes of the meeting, they talked about how the procedures would actually go. And in most cases, they probably will just let some of the – remember, they own an increasing amount of the supply of bonds, right? So part of the reason, if you think about it like this, the deficit has been going down, so the Treasury has been issuing fewer debt, less bonds, right? And so if they kept buying at the rate in which they were buying – they're sucking up too much of the supply of high-quality collateral or fixed income. And remember, banks use that high-quality collateral for interbank lending. Institutional investors use that to sort of post collateral in certain transactions. So you can't suck up all of the supply without creating dislocation or disruption. And that's what has very much started to happen. So the Fed says, wait a minute, I have to start slowing down. I'm eating too much. So it's like pulling back from the table at Thanksgiving, right? And so the idea is they went from $85 billion, now we're down to $45 billion a month, but they're still buying. If they keep trailing down at the pace they're going, by the fall, there'll be no more QE for now, right?
Right.
Now, the interesting question will be, what if we ever have a recession again in this country? I think QE will become the go-to move, and you'll see them right back there buying again. But how they will actually, you know, raise rates is interesting, because the way they would normally do it, they can't. In other words, how they would extract the liquidity is for the reason that you said. Most of the, when people say Fed is printing money, it's not printing money. It essentially, it creates liquidity that ends up where? On the balance sheet of banks, right? It ends up on the bank balance sheet.
Right.
So how they withdraw that becomes a lot harder, because there's so much liquidity on bank balance sheets that the typical way you would raise rates, the federal funds rate, won't work. Just like it would drain liquidity. Well, it's not like draining a bathtub anymore. It's like draining a swimming pool. How they do that is anybody's guess.
So you don't have an answer. Nobody really knows. I mean, this is going to be really interesting. I guess we're writing textbooks now for future MBA classes, I guess. Because nobody seems to know. Let's hope that it doesn't hurt us too much. Craig, I'd like to stay with us. I've got a couple more questions to ask you. So, folks, stay with us. We've got Craig Columbus, Chief Market Strategist, Senior Managing Director, First Allied Asset Management. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Mike Robertson Show, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. Back in a minute.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We're pleased to have with us today, if you're just joining us, Mr. Craig Columbus. Craig is Chief Market Strategist, Senior Managing Director of First Allied Asset Management, and a very good friend of mine and a person that I truly personally admire. He is one of the really good guys on Wall Street. Craig, before we were before the break, we were talking about interest rates and where things are going. And one of the things that's really – it kind of confounded me a little bit. I kind of pride myself in having some idea which rates are going. I didn't exactly buy into the 4% numbers and the various numbers that I saw, but I thought, okay, it's about time for rates to start at least inching up a little bit. I knew that Janet Yellen didn't really want to. I remember a speech that she gave about 2 years ago in which she saw that she didn't see rates moving until 2016. This was on the heels of a speech that Ben Bernanke gave that he didn't see rates moving up to 2015. So I thought, well, maybe, maybe not. But I certainly didn't see them moving down like they did. And suddenly, when I opened my eyes, they were down below 2.5 on the 10-year. What, you know, what caused all that? Why are they falling?
So remember last year when the Fed first announced that it would contemplate tapering or slowing down its bond buying, interest rates went up. We went from about 150, which was the all-time low on the 10-year Treasury. We ended the year around 3%. And the expectation was Fed is buying less bonds each month, so rates will continue to rise because the biggest buyer, the 800-pound gorilla of the buying of bonds, is going to exit the stage. That isn't what happened. Rates have gone the other way, down exactly as you said. So it tells you, traditionally you would say, because it's signaling you, bond market is always thought of as the smartest market, is signaling you slower growth. And particularly if you look at the spread between the 10-year Treasury and the 2-year Treasury, or the 30-year Treasury and the 10-year Treasury, both of those spreads have been narrowing or flattening. That usually is a big sign the economy is slowing because the demand for credit is less. When the economy is growing, the demand for credit goes up and the spread between the 10-year and the 30-year widens. That isn't what's happening. So we're in an unbelievably complex scenario where stocks are making new highs and bonds are making new highs, right, because the price goes up on bonds and the yields go down. So it begs the question, why? Here's my rationale for why I think it's happening. First of all, some of it's of the Fed's own making. When they ended QE1 and they ended QE2, in both cases, yields fell. It's counterintuitive. You'd think yields would go up. They're buying less bonds. But some of it is they've conditioned the market to think if the Fed isn't in there buying with all this liquidity pumping the prime, the economy will slow. So they're somewhat trapped, a victim of their own liquidity. The second thing is pension funds have done very, very well. If you think about it over the last 5 years, many pension funds have recovered. So they look at their funding requirements and they say, wait a minute, I need to lock in some of that. I'll swap some of my stocks for bonds because I have obligations, right? So they need to lock in their funding status. So pension funds go and say, wait a minute, I'll add more to bonds. They're a buyer of bonds. In addition to that, you have the European Central Bank engaging in its own type of quantitative easing stimulus. Not yet, but they're hinting that they're going to do that in June. So the yield on all these bonds like France and Spain, which are very marginal credits, fall down to 3, 3.5. That the German 10-year is like 160, 170. The Japanese 10-year yields, you know what the Japanese 10-year yields? 60 basis points. So all around the world, people say, wait a minute, yields are falling all around the world. I'd rather take the marginal credit. I'd rather have the safety of the 10-year Treasury. For all those reasons, yields have fallen rather than risen, and we're left in a place where stocks and bonds make a new high at the same time.
Wow. Now, could we go lower? Because I've actually heard predictions of 1.5, that going back, I think that was the low back in 2012, was like 1.47, 1.3, something like that.
Exactly.
Could we get back down there?
Well, I think that is going to depend a lot on what happens in the real economy. Because what I thought was really noticeable was that for this whole year, we had been trapped in a range on bonds. On the 10-year Treasury, let's call it 250 on the low end, 285 on the high end. And whenever Euro geopolitical tensions would spike, Ukraine, we would test the bottom end of that range. Whenever the economy would show some sign of improving, we would test the high end of that range. But last week, or 2 weeks ago, we dropped and made a new low without really any spike in geopolitical tensions. In other words, Ukraine has kind of been off the front pages, and yet the bonds still made new lows. That's a sort of a concerning sign about where we are in terms of the real economy. So can we go lower? Yes. But how much lower? Well, I think it's a function of if the economy continues to slow more, or can we now work our way out of this winter weather hangover and start to get a pickup, and that really guide us on how much lower we go on bonds.
So the I think it's the jury's still out. We'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Well, the jury is out.
Yeah. Let me cover another topic with you that was a real shocker to me. Peggy and I went to the Money Show last week, and or week before last. When was it?
A couple weeks ago.
And I interviewed a bunch of people out there, and I started out with Dr. Gary Schilling. And Dr. Schilling, very bright man. I have a lot of respect for Gary. He sits down and tells me that he really believes that we're in a deflationary environment and makes a very good case for it. Well, and I interviewed several people. At the end, we interviewed Dr. Mark Skousen. Mm-hmm. And he made the case for inflation. And both of them sounded really, really great. I mean, if that was the only interview that you heard, you would have thought, wow, I know exactly which way things are going. And so I walked away. I just kind of shook my head because I thought, boy, I tell you what, you know, I've been in this business 39 years, and this one threw me for a loop. If I were a consumer out there, I'd have no idea what's going on. What is your feeling? Are we in a deflationary environment? Are we in an inflationary environment? Or is the porridge just warm and we're really going nowhere?
Well, it's the great debate. So the deflationists say, their prime argument would be, whenever you have a big credit bubble, and we've had a big credit bubble, and not just government borrowing, but we've had a credit bubble in household credit. So we had to delever, right? We had a housing bubble in this country. And whenever you have to work off, it's like a hangover. Whenever you have a big credit, you tend to bubble, you tend to see a deflationary environment. People say, look, I'm in no rush to go out and buy the marginal good. The inflationist argument would be, yes, your CPI or your government statistics for inflation are very low, benign. The Fed says, look, it's well below my 2% threshold for inflation. But the cost of living, the things that you actually consume, particularly food, energy, healthcare, education, all of those show no signs of going down. In fact, they go up, right? And this year, food prices in particular, if you look at the food index, has really seen a big spike. Coffee, the meat, bacon, all of those items are really going through. So you may say, well, boy, the government says inflation is low, but when I go to the grocery store, inflation sure doesn't feel low. So you have to separate sort of cost of living and inflation. The reason why I would tend to favor more of the deflationary camp is that I think that credit bubble is real. It takes a long time to work off the hangover, but it's the wages. You don't see wage inflation. To really get a big jump in inflation, you need wages to be going up. And in most parts of the country and in most segments, you have seen no wage inflation yet. Now, I think it's coming, building, but not there yet. So I would tend to err more on the deflation camp at the moment.
Now, I need to ask you, do you have a few more minutes? I don't know what your schedule is. Could I hold you over for just a little bit more of the next segment?
Of course.
Okay, because I've got a couple more questions. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Europe, and I'd like to talk about housing, which is really interesting because the numbers showed recently at the most recent announcement that the home prices were cooling, but yet month-to-month and year-over-year basis were increased. So I find that really interesting, and, of course, housing is a big part of the market. So we're fortunate to be able to hold over Craig Columbus for just one more segment. So stay with us, folks. You're listening to Mike Robertson's show, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. And today we've got Craig Columbus, Chief Market Strategist, Senior Managing Director at First Allied Asset Management. Back in just a moment. Stay with us.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Okay, I've got to go real fast because there's so much I want to ask Craig. And we've got with us today Craig Columbus, Chief Market Strategist, Senior Managing Director, First Allied Asset Management. By the way, he's got a great book called Gone and Man on Wall Street, The Conscience of Capitalism. Go to Amazon.com, pick up a copy. All right, I don't know where to start. Let's start on housing because it's a big part of the economy. It's a big part of that jobs pickup that you were talking about the last segment. And the numbers show that home prices are cooling, but nevertheless, they reflect increases on month over month and year after year. And a lot of people that think that housing prices are flat at best, what's your thought on the housing market?
Well, we've seen certain markets like my market, Phoenix, Las Vegas, you've seen a lot of professional buyer come into the market. And the hedge funds have been the huge marginal buyer of single-family housing. true statement. Hedge funds, the big institutions, have been the big marginal buyer because they want the cash flow. Interest rates are very low. Their borrowing cost is very, very minimal, and they get the cash flow because it creates rental income. And that's what you've seen. Institutions come into market where they're distressed properties, buy up thousands of homes, rent them, take the cash flow. Right now, someday that supply is going to come back onto the market. Interesting. The other thing is the first-time home buyer has almost evaporated. The first-time home buyer market is very, very soft. And what's it been replaced by? Institutional buyer, chock full of cheap money, going out and bidding up prices, so it keeps the first-time home buyer, who, oh, by the way, is struggling with student loan debt, being able to enter the market. That's not what we want for America, right? We don't want housing being in the hands of institutional professional buyer, right? I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that as an investment technique, but housing as an asset that people own in and live in is ultimately what we want. So I think the marginal buyer has been bid up, the price has been bid up by institutions. That's created a lot of distortions in the housing market. Ultimately, we need the first-time home buyer to come back.
Yeah, and they're not in there right now. They really aren't. Europe, okay, now, you know, in fact, early this year, so many of the pundits and talking heads are saying, go to Europe, you know, that prices and of stocks over here are overpriced, but you can get the much greater value in Europe. And then had other people come out saying, well, wait a minute, Europe is not nearly as good a shape as you think. What's your thought on Europe?
Okay, interesting relative valuation question. You remember how we said the U.S. economy has been held back by very bad winter weather, right? And that's going part of the excuse for why we had such poor data, including housing data. The U.K. had as bad of weather as we had in the U.S. Horrific flooding in many parts of the United Kingdom. But the U.K. economy is doing much better. The U.K. economy, to me, is the bright spot of the G10. Now, that's very different from continental Europe. Continental Europe, as you know, next week, Mr. Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, the counterpart to Mrs. Yellen, will likely engage in their own version of QE because they have deflation in Europe. No question, deflation, falling prices, and in part because the euro has been so strong. So European exporters cry foul and say, wait a minute, you have to weaken the euro to help me. So they've been trying to talk down the euro with all of these potential or coming stimulus measures, one of which could include negative depositive rates. So they're hinting, maybe, what would that mean? That would mean they would charge institutions to park short-term money. That's negative deposit rate. You haven't seen that anywhere in the world for a very, very long time. That's in part why you see bond yields falling. So I think next week you will see some very aggressive moves from the European Central Bank. But just remember, it's not as easy to engage in QE as it is here. What do we do here? Fed says, wait a minute, I'll go buy U.S. Treasuries, I'll go buy U.S. mortgage-backed securities. How many countries are there in the Eurozone? A lot. So you can't go say, well, I'm going to go buy Portugal bonds, I'm going to go buy Spain bonds, I'm going to go buy Italy bonds. It's not as simple as that. So the devil will be in the details. The market is expecting big stimulus coming from the Europeans. What that looks like, we'll have to wait and see next week.
Wow. All right, and I just have to have you do this because during the break you were really talking about, an explanation of our quantitative easing, getting people to spend money, making them feel rich and they're not really rich, and how everybody else is beginning to copy us. Can you kind of go over that again? I thought that was excellent.
So QE, Mr. Bernanke perfected the QE, and in fact he's since left office has been telling people at private dinners, for which they charge a very high fee, I don't think rates may not normalize or get back to sort of the normal level, even in his own lifetime, he says. Now, why is that? Because QE is painless in many respects in the short run. The Japanese are engaged in QE, even bigger than the Americans. Europeans, the UK had their own type of QE. Everybody copied Mr. Bernanke's playbook. Why? Because the answer is when you inject all this liquidity into the system, asset prices rise. Stock market, housing prices all rise. Corporations say, wait a minute, I can go borrow at very, very cheap rate. I can buy back my own stock. That makes my company more profitable. It makes the stock price go up. It makes my earnings look better. The government says, wait a minute, this is fantastic. I get more tax receipts because capital gains are going up. People are selling homes. But by the way, my borrowing costs have gone down because my monetary policy, my central bank, is buying my own debt. So I'm borrowing at record low rates. meaning I can spend more. My tax receipts go up at the same time. This is fantastic. Where do I sign up for that? So consumers feel richer. Their stock prices have gone up. Their home prices have started to recover. Their borrowing cost of the government has gone down. The government can spend more. Their tax receipts go up. But as we all know, right, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And someday, it won't be so painless.
Wow. So, you know, we really don't know how this is going to end, do we?
No, and that's the point I want to make. And we can be, and this may sound evasive, but in some ways, nobody should be too confident in how it ends. Because it's a play that's never been written. This movie script of going out and buying your own debt at this level, quantitative easing, is only the purview of the Argentinas. And no central bank, major central bank, and at the same time, they're all engaged in the same thing. The Japanese, the UK, the Europeans, and the Americans, all engaged at the same time in the mother of all quantitative experiments. How that ends is anybody's guess. Anybody's guess.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that you've got so many people, so many baby boomers, for instance, that are coming into retirement, and interest rates are at historic lows. And looking forward, I don't see any reason for them to go up. The biggest borrower is the federal government, so the biggest, the 800-pound gorilla doesn't want them to go up. It's going to be it could be a long, long time, a la Japan, before we see higher rates, can't it?
Well, that's what's called financial repression, because the government becomes so indebted that it is then trapped in the fact saying, even if rates went up just a little bit, I couldn't afford it. And the Japanese are kind of in that trap right now. And so you make the huge point. The dark side of QE is it favors the debtor over the saver. The saver who says, wait a minute, I'm looking for yield for retirement income, and I'm seeing a 10-year treasury yielding 250. Or think about it, savings account yielding almost nothing. But who benefits? The debtor, the person that says, oh, I'm a borrower. My borrowing costs are very, very low. And that's the true dark side, that it favors the debtor over the saver.
Wow. Any recommendations out there? If you were giving, we've got less than a minute, asset allocation recommendations. Are you a 60-40 man, 70-30, 50-50? What are you looking at right now?
Well, I do believe in asset allocation. I think it's a really important technique because in all of the big endowments, I've been doing a lot of work on big endowments lately, they truly believe in that core asset allocation technique. And that's a function of your risk tolerance, your preferences, your time horizon, your liquidity needs. So I think sort of the long-term asset allocation, and then you have some tactical piece of your portfolio
right,
that can adjust to changes in market environments. I think that's the right blend.
All right, Greg, thank you so much for being with us today. Folks, thank you for listening. It's a pleasure to be with you each and every day. I hope you have a great day. Hope you make a little money today. More than anything else, hope God blesses you and your family. God bless, folks. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.